the names of the characters that start with those letters and count vowels we can use. And I was like, guys. Ladies, gentlemen, and those with the good sense to do away with the whole notion, I welcome you to the premier audio medium for all your Fazbear entertainment needs. The Freddy Fazbear Pizza Podcast.
Note, FFPB is not responsible for anyone's hypothetic disinterest, dismemberment, or other legally classified statuses.
So strap in and enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Freddy Fazbear Pizza Podcast. I'm your host with the toast, Rye Toast, here with an incredibly special guest. Why don't you go and introduce yourself?
Hello, I go by SqueezeTheCorgi online. I'm the developer of Shipwreck 64, which is an indie horror game that came out 1st of January this year. And it's made its rounds, I say. So, yeah, that's who I am.
Underselling yourself as always. Folks, if you've watched this channel, you know I'm obsessed with this game. I've streamed it like maybe 6 times separately throughout this year already. and I'll tell you what, I want my number one spot back, so it's not going to be the last time I stream it. But yeah, we are talking about kind of Shipwreck 64, the development, the backstory, kind of the behind the scenes. I really like this game. And this is going to be more of an interview kind of episode, because I've never done that before. So hopefully this goes well. And if it goes horribly, it goes horribly. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
So I guess the first question, kind of a way to an easier question to kind of break the ice and get everything known. How has the reception to Shipwreck 64 been? Not only to the game itself, but also how has that kind of transformed the public opinion of Broadside Beach, of past projects? Like, how has the release of Shipwreck 64 affected you and your work?
Okay, it went better than I expected. We'll put it like that. When I made this game, I made it for, like, a very small audience. I expected this to be, like, niche. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to take off in the slightest. I wanted to keep it to, like, a very small crowd. Truth be told, when I found out that Poppy was releasing the same month, I thought it was going to be, like, dead and buried within the month, but it's still around somehow. Yeah, the reception has been better than I expected. I don't know how it's at an overwhelmingly positive on Steam. I'm not complaining, but I would like to keep it there. But, like, I'm still surprised it's at that point in the first place.
I mean, I've got some ideas on why it's at overwhelmingly positive, but that would just be me glazing you up for 10 minutes, so we'll move on.
Fair enough.
I think the first of it was one of those moments where I know in the community, I'll be honest, I knew about kind of Shipwrecked and I've heard about Broadside Beach before, like, I think the most I've heard of Shipwreck 64 was kind of the meme in the lead up to it, where, like, every time we were playing some kind of game or, like, on the haunted SMP or something, it was always like, oh yeah, wishlist Shipwreck 64. Like, that's how I knew about it. That was, like, my first exposure, realistically.
My sincerest condolences.
No, it was a funny bit. And then, so when it came out, I was like, oh, hell yeah, I'm going to finally play this. And I wasn't ready for what I played. I was kind of, it was a lot because I didn't even watch Broadside Beach until like a week or two after playing Shipwreck 64. I didn't know anything going in. I was completely blind. I didn't play the demo, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess that would be another question, because I do have some prepared questions, but on the topic of that, has, obviously with the eyes on Shipwreck 64, how has the increase towards, I guess, Broadside Beach or other projects by you, has that gone up relatively with all of this going on?
Kind of, not really. Most people are mostly interested in, like, Shipwrecked itself. So, like, for instance, I used to make, like, FNAF fan games, like, way back then. And one of them was called Polar Dread. That game has been basically unaffected by Shipwreck. People see it as, like, people don't even know that I made it. We don't even know that it's, like, the same person.
I'm going to be so real with you. I have ADHD. I have bad memory. I don't know if you have told me this in the past. I was talking to David Barron on the last episode about like VR games and fan games, and he was like, and he was talking to me about how Polar Dread is one of the best examples of like a VR FNAF styled game.
Yeah,
I didn't know that was your game. I knew I knew you had made another game, like other projects in the past. It didn't click in the moment where I was just like, "Oh, that sounds sick. I'll put it on my list to play." I didn't realize it didn't click.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. I'd say it's kind of aged a little bit, but like for what it's worth, I'd say it's a pretty good game.
Fair. I mean, making any kind of VR game like just is already impressive with all the like intricacies that have to go into it.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
I started out doing like basically like only VR stuff when I learned Unreal for the first time.
Okay.
So yeah, so the first thing I did was it was called Sub-Zero. That eventually got turned into Polar Dread, which is like a revamp of the same game. And then I started Shipwrecked in about 2021, I think, and just kept building on it from there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to go into that. So more on, I guess, the development side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, from the demo of Shipwreck 64 to the full release, there were obviously quite a few changes which makes sense. but one of the more interesting points, because I think at the face of it, like, of course, more content is going to be added. It will be a deeper experience. One of the changes I didn't expect when hearing about the two would be the drastic difference in art style.
Right.
So I guess, was that a conscious choice of I want to go with a different art style, or was it more a matter of we have more time on this, I want to tweak some things, and it just changed along the way?
Okay, so the thing is, when I originally started with Shipwrecked, I originally intended it to be almost like a Petscop situation. It's like a video that it's like a game that I make for myself and record, have some like narration going over, like, oh my god, that was so scary, guys. Oh no.
Okay.
But the thing is, as a result of that, I kind of fell into the same trap a lot of these other, you know, this game I found genre people do, where they get incredibly sloppy with like the actual assets being used. So if you look closely at some of the Shipwrecked assets, for instance, they're just like straight up stolen from Mario 64. I just edited it over top of them to like make my own. So like, for instance, Bucky's model is literally just Super Mario, but like edited to look like Bucky, and that's why it looked so bad at the time. And it was also when I was first learning Unreal, it was in the first couple of years I started learning it. So there was no lighting. The entire game ran completely unlit and relied on like a VHS shader on top of it. And with a new one, I kind of realized like this game looks nothing like an N64 game. It looks abhorrent. So that was like my first thing with the Steam one. I started out by making the models totally from scratch. I gave them more like diverse facial features so I could actually like animate their mouths, talk, and stuff like that. I just want to make it so that, one, I wouldn't get sued by Nintendo. That's like a big thing.
But that, also that's a good like, one. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. But also just like I wanted it to look better than it looks. The old one looked like super tacky. I'm actually like shocked that they took that one seriously.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't like, I think a lot of people when seeing the demo, the reaction was more so just like, oh yeah, this looks older. So I didn't think it was like, I don't think, at least as far as I'm aware, I wasn't obviously in the community until the release of the full game, but as far as I'm aware from what I've heard, the reaction wasn't really like, oh, this looks like an asset flip. It was, oh, this, you know, it looks like an older styled game, you know? Now that you point out Bucky was a edited version of Mario, I see it. Like, now that you pointed out, I'm like oh, shit, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, like, even Stumbler started as just like a MIPS edit. And then I just became
something. Oh, yeah.
That's why he has no arms. Or I thought it was going to be like a cool design choice. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of just stuck with it. And that's kind of how I ended
up. I actually had a question. We can touch on that now. Because I've got a couple questions on character designs. And I've the way, for anyone who hasn't played Shipwreck 64, obviously go play it. Link is in the description. But the way I've structured today's episode, we're going to be very light on spoilers. And the things we do talk about that are spoiled, just because you kind of have to talk about it if we're doing a full interview on this stuff, will be in the second half, and there will be a clear distinction. So don't worry about spoilers if you haven't played it. But if you have played it, which you should have, don't worry about it anyway. But I do have a question on, and I guess maybe it should wait until spoilers, but we'll dance around the subject just while you brought it up. Character design in general with Bucky and the gang, right? We have the look at me audience, two designs of these characters, where we have the and we'll talk about something else later, where we have this N64 and costume designs, right? I would love to hear if there were any specific inspirations going into those characters of Bucky and the gang, Stumbler, and even the residents of Terra Nol.
Okay, so when I was first starting out with it, the project originally started as... Are you familiar with Five Nights at Treasure Island? Like, do you know what that is?
Yes, yeah, I'm familiar.
So originally, it was kind of like my attempt at rewriting that into like an original thing. Because I used to make fan games of Treasure Island all the time. I took this one concept I really liked and wanted to try and make it into its own thing. And the first thing I started by doing was kind of making the equivalent of each character. So in this case, Bucky would be this company's kind of a Mickey equivalent. And then Minnie is Olive. Goofy would be Walter. And then Donald is Giovanni. Stuff like that. I started out with just like the basics.
Okay.
In terms of like the, you know, the sailor attire, it's because originally, you know, it was going to take place on an island. So I figured giving them like the sailor outfits would be like the best way to handle that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's kind of how we started out in that regard, at least.
Yeah, because I see kind of that personality inspiration as well, kind of cranked up as well. Where obviously none of them are one-to-one, but when I think about the roles those characters fill, that makes a lot of sense. Especially, I've got two kids. The amount of Mickey Mouse Clubhouse I've watched is off the charts. Mm-hmm. Donald, you know, kind of a piece of shit. kind of a fucker, and I see that role being filled by my beloved Giovanni. I love that guy, but yeah. I see that inspiration line, so that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And then I guess compared to their like the specifics of their in-game their in-game designs to their costume designs, what was the kind of, was there like a process or a method for taking these? Was it like in-game design first and how do we make it realistic, but also a little off-putting? Or was it, you always had these ideas for the costumes and then went to simplify them down?
Right. So this is going to sound stupid. We started out because like back in like 2020, when I first had this idea, it was going to take place on the actual, like the resort that the game was hosted at.
Yeah.
After it was abandoned. So we started with the Starling designs. That was the first thing we did.
Interesting.
We actually had to reverse engineer them back into the cute versions.
All the way from the Starling. Interesting.
Yeah. And then from there we went to the N64 version. So we kept simplifying them as time went on, basically.
You know, I kind of... Well, one, it's not stupid. But I see the idea of... thinking about the designs of the Starlings, which we'll get more in depth later... I kind of do it. I just visualizing them. I can see it as like, here's a cool standalone design. How do we make the normaled version of that?
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. Kind of visualizing it out. Interesting. Yeah. And then as far as like the residents of Terra Nol go, was the plan always going to? Now, forgive me. I did research, but I haven't fully brushed up on all things Broadside Beach, so I don't know what crosses over back and forth with that as well. Was the plan always wolves or wolves?
Okay, so wolves came into the picture around early 2022 when I was first planning out the actual shipwreck game. So sure. Like they were pretty early on, but they weren't part of like Broadside Beach when it was just a series. That came a little bit later. And originally there was only going to be just one, which was Chief. And they added the other ones, like kind of like just residents that would wander around the place.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that for now we'll cover our character design questions because I have some other specific character design questions we'll save for the latter half. As far as the game itself goes, was the plan always Nintendo 64 styled platformer? Because that's a really interesting choice that I haven't seen much of as far as like platformers go in the indie horror space.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a tricky process, but we started out originally the first concept I ever had back in like I think it was either March or April of 2021 was like an old computer game, But then later on, I was like, wait, what if we, like, instead of that, I want to do something more, like, 3D. I already know Unreal and everything like that. I don't want to have to use Clickteam again. So I remembered in 2020, I got introduced to this thing. It was the Mario 64 Iceberg. I don't know if you remember that, but it was, like, every copy of Mario 64 is personalized. Here's everything that can happen. It was, like, weird occurrences that just don't make sense.
Vaguely, I remember that. Again.
Yeah. Stuff like that is kind of where the whole idea kind of came from. Because, like, truth be told, I didn't really grow up with the N64. I wasn't really familiar with it until I started researching it. But
I'm the same way. I think my first consoles were, like, PS1, GameCube. I never really played the N64 until much later in life.
Yeah. But, like, in this case, I was just, like, I don't know, I felt like as soon as I saw that, I was like, this could make a killer game concept. And I just wanted to take that idea and, like, run with it.
Interesting.
And then I came with Broadside a little bit later on, and eventually I just kind of, like, merged the two together, and that's kind of where the idea came from.
Awesome. Interesting. Yeah. I will say, you're telling me there is a universe where Shipwreck 64 is like a go-kart racer.
Not even like a go-kart racer. It's going to be like one of those, like, early point-and-click games.
Okay.
Just, like, look up for.
Well, I know with the Mario Kart 64 Iceberg, I was thinking about the, like, personalization of there. I was like, oh man. Yeah. I heard kart racer and I salivated. So I, interesting. Yeah. I think that was, it was a really good standout moment. Cause I think that's from what I've seen in the Shipwreck 64 post release talkings is one of the aspects that has a lot of people coming back is the actual gameplay. Because I don't know if you, I'm sure there was, intentionality in a lot of this. I don't know if you intended to make it feel as fun to move around as you did, but it's really fun to move around as Bucky. So,
yeah, so like way earlier on when I was first starting out with the game, like even as far as like the 2022 version that actually released, that was literally just like a very heavily modified like Unreal first third person template. It was not fun to control, and I think about as fast as it could go at a time was like 600 units at a time. It's pretty slow for like Unreal standards. It's not great.
Yeah.
Like when I made the new one, I wanted to really go all out with the platform. Make it not only make it feel authentic, but just like I wanted to make it feel like, you know, something that could exist, but also allow for some good enemy encounters. That was like a main priority with the movement system. I wanted to make it so you can have like really close calls with it. So.
Yeah. No, I totally feel that. And as someone who has speedrun a lot of this game.
Mm-hmm.
The movement and having to avoid enemies with that movement is the main reason, at least myself, and I'm feeling a lot of other people keep coming back for the speedrun of it. Because I'm not huge on speedrunning like horror games, because frankly, a lot of horror games aren't very fun to speedrun.
Yeah.
So it was very refreshing to be like, oh, I like moving around in this. I want to keep doing that.
Yeah, that was, like, the main thing. I wanted to make it feel, like, really polished to actually control them. Which, there's obviously some issues still. Like, the wall jumping isn't great, and I know the...
Sure.
The mantling can be a little broken at times. I don't really know how to fix that. But, yeah.
I know I couldn't tell you. And then there's also the charm of that, of, like, the idea of a Nintendo 64 game having some aspects that you can kind of manipulate to do weird movement and things like that. I know watching David Barron's stream of it was just watching somebody throw their head at a wall several times to see if they could find a crack, you know?
Yeah. I will say, something I did like about the, was, like the speedrunning and everything like that, people have, like, found a way to, like, manipulate the movement system so heavily. Like, I saw someone find out a way to skip the entire plaza. Just by like, it was they use a combination of the keypad and like jumping, because the keypad moves you around. It actually clipped them outside the like the boundaries of the map, where they're able to kind of jump up and climb on the on like where the floor meshes. They're able to like circle all the way around the plaza and access the exit door from the back. I don't know how they pulled it off, but it blew my mind.
I'm going to have to look that up, because that sounds really cool. Because I know, I did find the oopsie whoopsie skip, but that's so not fun to do, because the only
Which
way...
Which one is that?
That was the one where if you play through the game fully, all the way through, without saving, and then let the game naturally get back to the main menu without closing the game, and then start a new game without saving, get all the way through again... The second time, and so in the second playthrough, when you enter the plaza door, it takes you right to the plaza exit door. And then when you enter that, you exit the elevator right before the final encounter.
Man, this game is barely held together. Oh my god.
I have no idea how it works. It took, dude. I think Big Fungus had to like figure it out how to replicate it, because I tried to replicate it for like 2 hours. I'm like, I don't know why this is working. And then Big Fungus was like, we figured it out.
Yeah, I've never been great at like coding save systems. So I don't know, it's difficult to at least.
I mean, it spawned a new category. The New Game Plus speedrun category is doing that skip. They made it a separate one, because the only way to do the skip is to fully play the game once and then let it cycle back to the main menu. Mm-hmm. I guess there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about that I am worried about spoilers. So we'll shift gears to that, since we're about approaching halfway. So like I mentioned, if you haven't played this game, what's wrong with you? The link is in the description. But we are going to start talking about spoilers, and it won't ruin your experience, but it is a very special experience to play the game without spoilers. So I urge you to do so. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm opening that can, let's step back to character design. So we mentioned the Starlings and how that was kind of the beginning. What about character? I'm very curious to hear the design philosophy behind three characters in particular.
Right.
We'll start with Blot.
Okay.
Blot is very interesting in a lot of ways. Did Blot ever have a like normal N64 model? Or was it also like the Blot we see in game first?
Okay, so with Blot in particular, he was kind of like, we did him differently, because he had like three different iterations.
Mm-hmm.
Where originally he was like, he was almost like an exact replica of Oswald. And then we changed design late 2022, and then again late 2023, and we actually like fully introduced him into the game and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with just like the paperboy design. You can actually see we used a bit of the concept art in the in Rex's like in the gallery in layer 2. You can actually like see the concept art we used.
Yeah. Okay.
For Blot, it's just framed there. So we definitely started with the concept aspect of that first, and it kind of we went to the monster design. And that was kind of where things got a little bit more difficult, because I had, like, a very distinct idea for what I wanted in mind. I think the hard part with him in particular was just, we wanted to stand out from the others. We wanted to make him feel very different.
Yeah.
So we started out by just not giving him color. Like, his costume as a whole is still in black and white to match the era he's supposed to be from.
Yeah, it's very jarring, because you also first encounter him in a very colorful area, generally.
Yeah, and then most of the color you see on him is coming from, like, the blood stained the suit. I always thought that was kind of like an interesting detail.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the actual model, you can't see it, because it's only on the HD model, not on the N64. But you might notice that there's, like a big gash on his back in the N64 version.
Yeah.
On the HD model, it's actually, like, a seam. You can see, like, the pulsating stuff on the inside of him. And it just was sewn up kind of improperly. The resolution's too low to see it on the actual in-game model. But, like, there's a lot of detail on it that just makes him look disgusting. Even, as far as the hands go, I wanted to make it, like, really look like you can see how, like, mangled this guy is. Mm-hmm. So his middle finger and his ring finger actually conjoined into one, and it looks so uncomfortable.
Interesting.
But I love how he came out, honestly.
Yeah, it's a very... It's a one of those moments... Because there's a lot of moments in the games, in this game, where you go... Oh shit. And I think the first one is your first, we'll say, footage that you see. And I have a whole couple questions on those. And then when you first leave layer one, I think is another one of those moments. But one of those big moments is meeting Blot, right? Because at that point, you've already had so many turns that you're like, okay, I think I know where we're going now. I'm starting to see where this is coming together. And then suddenly there's a new character that, like, sure, you saw the concept design way back when, but, like, it feels like you get blindsided with it. And it's in an area that seems very peaceful. Because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the first time you can encounter him is in that, like, office aquarium looking place, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like he's always active in there. And then he can be activated in the sewers once all the gates are opened. But that's, like, it's like a rarer chance to experience
that. Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people, at least I did, and I saw in a lot of playthroughs that, like, it was, we went to the, what is the actual name of that, like, blue and white area right before the...
I just call it the aquarium.
The aquarium, okay. I feel like a lot of people, at least myself, I did, I wandered around the aquarium for a bit and then went, okay, I can't do anything here, let's go somewhere else and explore. But it was like, let me explore here first. And it was like, oh, okay, we finally made it to, like, a clean... I think I remember hearing something similar to this earlier in one of the logs. What the fuck is that? Right?
Yeah. It hits you out of nowhere.
Yeah, so that was a really good turn on that. And obviously, like you said, Blot's design is dope. Speaking of interesting design, now this might come from me not watching anything from Broadside Beach. Again, I that was the thing I didn't get into before Shipwreck 64. So this was very like, what is that? Husk. Obviously, you know, there are things that you're planning in the background that I don't want to spoil any lore, things like that, that you have not or are not ready to reveal yet. But as far as the design for Husk goes, what was that process like?
Okay, so what was it? I think it was like April 2022. I saw this one YouTuber named Alex Bale, who he made this one really good series called Happy Meat Farms, or The Muse, whatever you're going to call it. Really
yeah, good. I think I've seen that.
Yeah. But on April Fool's, he released a video where he had AI like generate a SpongeBob theory for him. As like it was like SpongeBob conspiracy theory stuff.
Sure.
I didn't know about AI generation at the time at all. It was my first exposure to it ever. And I got bored, and I found the site he used, and I threw in a picture of Bucky to see what happened. I got like this really abstract-looking result. And I looked at it for a while, and we kind of worked on that, and we translated that into Husk's design after a while.
Interesting.
So he started as like a really abstract looking, you know, image. And then from there we took that and we actually gave it like a full 3D model. We tried to make it work with like, it's hard to make stuff like that work. Cause it's like one of the issues with using AI in the first place, aside from, you know, everything bad it does for artists.
Yeah. besides all the bad stuff.
Yeah. But like, it's incomprehensible. And like,
yeah,
I know like early AI stuff looked creepy. In a certain way, that's why I thought it was so interesting in the first place.
But yeah, like back when while, it, like, first started.
Yeah, like DALL-E and stuff. Like, I thought it was cool at the time. But, like, looking at it now, it's just, like, I don't... It's a miracle we got, like, a functional design out of Husk at all. But I think what we have is pretty good. I like how he's, like, a scarecrow, kind of, where it's, like...
He does have that vibe where it's, like, it looks like he's... It looks like he wouldn't move until he does.
Yeah. And, like, with the design in particular, he was... It's good, because I already had something planned for a character... like Husk. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to be yet, but like seeing like that weird wooden creature and the abstract image kind of sold me on it. So I decided I wanted to be like a creature that carved its own body out of wood. I thought that'd be like a really interesting kind of concept. And that's kind of where Husk came in.
Yeah, because I think the first time I saw Husk's design was in game, because I had stumbled upon the Stumbler, I have stumbled upon the voicemail in the dam level, where you have those two husks there, and I that was like the first, like, obviously I had seen actually no, because I went to the dam first. I think that was like the first like non 2023 or like non 2023 version of Shipwreck stuff I had seen, was that husk and the voicemail. So that was like my first like, what the hell is this guy?
I like how it looks in game. Like, it's like a pretty good model, all things considered.
Yeah, and the fingers especially are like really off-putting in a very fun way. And then finally, for character design, we didn't talk about Vandal.
Right.
One of the first. Now, I don't know specifically which secret it is, because I unlocked a couple before I went to look at the like gallery, but I feel like one of the first secrets you can unlock is the picture of Studio Grounds Vandal.
Yeah, it is actually.
Okay. Was that, I guess, was that kind of like your way of teasing what is to come, you know, in something you can unlock so early?
Well, yeah, no, so I wanted to introduce Vandal as early on as humanly possible. Because I feel like I wanted to feel like a lingering threat to make his absence in the actual game feel a little more jarring. Like, I know he shows up as JD at one point, And that's another thing. I wanted to kind of, like, leave that on because I want to reveal more about that later. But, like, Vandal's design in particular is so creepy to me. So I wanted to introduce him way early on to get this expectation running of, like, you're going to see him eventually, only for him to be, like, strangely absent through most of the game. That was kind of my idea with him.
Yeah, because that was, I remember I saw the image of him, and then that was the first thing I did in 97 was I was writing down the beaver scratch on one of the signs. And that was the sign where if you stay long enough, it triggers that, like, CCTV footage of
Vandal, I kind of figured people would do that. Yeah, that was intentional. I wanted to, like, have him stand it for long enough.
Yeah, I mean, you called it, because I was, like, the first thing I did in 97 was, oh, what's this sign? Oh, let me write this down. Hey, why is the screen getting darker? So, kind of on to Nulaterra in general. If this goes into lore spoilers that you don't want out there, feel free to let me know. But as someone who writes a lot of D&D campaigns, one of my go-to things for making names and worlds and places is I go into an English to Latin generator and I type in words that describe the place. So I immediately clocked that this is called No Land.
Okay. It's meant to be
What
no
is the
man's
idea
land?
Behind that?
It's meant to be no man's land, if I recall correctly.
Okay. Yeah, it's Latin's weird. But yeah, it's like no man's land, like nothing land, like void, essentially. Why was that the choice? If that's not too like spoiler heavy, I guess.
So my main thing was, like, this is established way later on in the game. You see that the island has, like, a massive, like, beating heart in it.
Yes.
That's not something that's, like, a metaphorical. It's not, like, exclusive to the game. There is, like, an actual beating heart under the real island that this game is based off. Okay. That's just, like, But the thing is, I wanted to establish that whatever is living on this island is not human. And whatever it's creating, that's not human either. I wanted to make it seem, right off the bat, that it is, like, this omnipotent force that is kind of, like... I don't know how to describe it.
So it kind of goes into the obituaries you unlock throughout the game as well, then.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Mm-hmm. No, and that makes sense then for specifically No Man's Land. Like, there are things on this island, but it's no man, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to emphasize, that's especially going forward in that regard, so.
Well, I guess, speaking of the different areas of the game, kind of the gameplay style of specifically the 97 version, were layers, like you said, the iceberg thing, you want to go into that, were layers always the plan, at least post point-and-click era of hashing out the game? Was it always the plan of, like, doing layers?
Yeah, so it was a little differently set up at first, but after a while, I wanted to make it a little more straightforward and make it more of, like, an actually playable game. But way earlier on, the layers are going to be, like, the equivalent of the Newmaker Plane in Petscop. It's like this big open air, lots of branching paths, and they all take you to different areas, which seem incomprehensible at first, but slowly build up over time. My main goal with it was just make it feel... it's like somewhere you're not supposed to be, if that makes sense. Like, I know everyone says that when describing these types of games in general, but I want to make it feel like you are somewhere that you do not belong in, and that you are, you know what I'm going for.
No, that makes total sense. And I agree with you that that first idea that is more, Casey, get off. My cat likes to knock over lighting when he feels bored. that idea of, I kind of agree with you, like you mentioned earlier, like, that original concept works really well for, like, a Petscop style of media.
Yeah.
But that is hard to teach a player naturally.
Not even that. I just feel like wandering around, like, these infinite open areas are just stopping fun after a while.
Fair.
It's just like,
There's also you'll never know if you found everything without looking for an external guide.
Yeah, either that or, like, encouraging, like, boundary breaking. That's not something I really wanted to do until... I started teasing it a little bit in the April Fool's update, but prior to that, I didn't really want players to, like, boundary break or fight, like, data mine it. I wanted them to solve it legitimately, start to finish within their own game client. That was That was just how I always wanted to anticipate. Like, I always wanted to do, like, a legitimate thing you can play start to finish without having, like, knowledge of files or anything like that. I didn't want it to be, like, accessible. So.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I praise this a lot, where I feel there are certain ARG and like puzzle mystery style horror games that aren't approachable. One of my go-to examples is always, and I love the game, don't get me wrong, it's always Courage the Cowardly Dog.
That one, no, I was actually going to point out that one, actually. Such an interesting concept, but like, how is any player ever supposed to understand
exactly
how that invisible maze works?
And the invisible maze is such a misstep.
Yeah, like having the game crash on you every time you mess up. That, I've never liked that. Games that like crash themselves, I find that so annoying. I want to make sure that Shipwreck never once did that. So I find it so annoying.
Interesting.
It
depends on the game for me, because there are certain games where I don't mind it. I think a game that does crashing well is I'm Scared.
Yeah.
Because it's less of a, you messed up, here's your punishment, and it's more, we're going to change the game now. It's like a chapter. But as far as like Courage the Cowardly Dog goes, I fully agree where like, it's such an, it's really well made until that maze, and then it falls apart.
Yeah, no, it's like, I'll never understand what any player is supposed to understand that in the first place, you know?
I think if somebody makes a mod for your game that makes the invisible maze visible, there's an issue.
Like, yeah.
And I understand the ARG component of like, oh, well, it's in the spectrograph. Okay, cool.
Yeah, but
allow
that
me to then upload it back to the game so I can at least see it in game now that I figure that out. But how am I supposed to find it in the first place?
Yeah, or like even then, something you could have done, which I try to do the Shipwreck when it comes to like the platform elements, use some sort of unique gameplay mechanic to your advantage in that maze. Like, for instance, imagine if Courage had an ability where you can see invisible objects like ghosts or something like that, but that becomes useful when you're actually like doing the maze. You'd see it in front of you. That would have been great.
You could have a radius around you almost. Kind of, exactly. Like a spooky version of the stuff in Super Mario Galaxy where the magnets go towards you and away from you when you walk past them.
Yeah, exactly. I would have loved something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like having, I don't know, it's like it feels so inaccessible with that maze in particular.
Mm-hmm. That's, I feel like with Shipwrecked, a lot of the puzzles in there had those ARG elements, but they weren't impossible. And that was the key.
Yeah.
Like there was a way to figure out everything just from playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, sometimes you had to take notes. I know a lot of people have their different notes as they played. I had like paper. I saw a lot of people with like notepad documents up.
Yeah.
I do have a question. There was I think all of the puzzles in there were solvable with no help or anything. But I know there were some puzzles in there that, after player feedback, you had changed or taken out.
Yeah.
So what was that like? What I guess hiccups were found post-release that you kind of went back and adjusted? And okay, is there, in retrospect, would you have done differently?
Okay. I think my biggest issue was the SOBT puzzle that locks the gallery in Layer 3. I don't think a single player enjoyed solving that one. It was just, you're listening to like this tape, which like, you know, it's already not great because you have a time making out what it's saying. And there is like a YouTube like mirror where you can like hear it and have the captions, but a lot of people aren't going to put the effort to find that. It's made worse with the fact that Giovanni's mechanic relies on audio. So players would say like it was like a very frustrating experience trying to get it to open at all, because every time we would play it, Giovanni would run over, and the AI at the start of the game, like before I like nerfed it a little bit more, they were insanely difficult and would spawn constantly. So players had no way of doing it. They're having to run back to a hiding spot every single time. And like that one in particular, I feel like I should have just axed. And then there's others that I wish I put in better hints for.
Because I do think the SOBT puzzle, I do remember at the time I was very confused. I think maybe if it wasn't in the plaza, that would have solved a lot of headaches. And I think you're right. Like, Giovanni especially is an aggressor there. Where, like, once you're not in the plaza, you can sit down and be like, okay, let's figure this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something I wish I did was I wish there was more areas where there's no threats after the plaza. I wish there was more of that, and I probably should have done that. Because, like, I feel like
that. Yeah. I think the barrels do help, though, right? The idea of, like, okay, I need to solve something. Let me find a safe spot.
Yeah. It's like with I remember Fiznom's playthrough, he literally said at one point, like, if the entire rest of the game is just hiding from enemies and putting in code, I'm content with not finishing it. And I don't know. I just wish I wish I had more elements where there's like downtime. That probably would have helped out a little bit more.
I see that. I think I personally, I think the barrels are the remedy there. I mean, I'm not a game designer. I don't know these things. But as far from my perspective, I think the barrels are a fine remedy there. But I guess sorry, go on.
I thought they were too. It's like a lot of players, they actually complain, like, I'm spending too much time hiding in barrels. I don't like it, you know? It's just like,
but that's the mechanic. Okay. Yeah. Speaking of hiding in barrels and stuff, kind of the Starlings mechanic and the separate mechanics, we touched on Giovanni being kind of attracted to sound. What was the, I guess, was there a specific reason why each character acted the way they did? Or was it more so just a way to diversify mechanics?
Okay, so it was kind of weird, but my main thing there was, well, yeah, one, I wanted to have it so each character is different. You have to pay attention to which one's active at a time. But it was also, like, other smaller things. Like, one of the big things, for instance, was I wanted to kind of play into each character's, like, strengths or kind of gimmicks I'd introduced earlier on. So Olivia, for instance, being able to show up in the borders of the screen to spot you was kind of like, I wanted to introduce it early on in the game for that one scare. Then it would be like a common theme with her in particular. She can do that. And then,
yeah, that's also great early scare. That the amount of times I've watched playthroughs and the things, like, I've watched enough playthroughs that I'm not going to watch everybody's full playthrough anymore. But there are moments I go to, and the first time Olivia pops up on the side, I will watch that reaction every time. Because that's such a good reaction.
I'm really proud of that scare still. Because, like, it took a lot of time to figure that out. Coding it was a nightmare, for the record. It took a long time to get that all set up.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's one thing. Like, I never even considered that. I think one of the great aspects of game design and storytelling and anything like that is establishing rules specifically to break them later on. And I didn't even consider 4-3 aspect ratio as a rule. I took it as a given, you know?
Yeah. But, like, that was something I did even with early Broadside Beach stuff. Like, Broadside Beach 2 did that exact same trick a couple times where we'd use the aspect ratio. I thought it was clever for the time, and I just kind of took it and ran with it, and I found out how to recreate it in Unreal. I was like, I have to use this, so.
Speaking of interesting visual choices, death animations, the capture animations, I guess is a better word to use there.
Yeah.
That is a visual style I've seen kind of on, like, memes and TikToks and stuff, where it's like one video bleeding into another video. I had not seen it in horror. Was that, like, how early in the process did that come about? Because that's a very intriguing visual style to go after.
Right. So I've been using that technique since about 2020. It's been, like, a long-running thing I've been liking to use. And I don't know what it is, but, like, in the right context, it can be, like, really creepy. And, I feel like it worked out here. Especially, I think Olive's the best one, because, like, she pops up and then it, like, bleeds into the water. I thought that was, like, a really cool transition.
Yeah, I Olive's was the first one who caught me, and I saw that. I was like, huh? You know, that was a really good, it's really refreshing. And I like the idea, kind of, and I assume this goes into what you mentioned earlier about not overly punishing players. Capturing versus death, I think, is very fun.
Yeah, because, like, even with the boss fight, I had a lot of negative feedback on that when I was having it tested, because originally they would take away 3 of your finds instead of just 1. Players really did not like that.
Fair.
I've had people even demanding that I remove the punishment as a whole and have it reset you back to the beach. I thought that was stupid.
Really? Yeah.
But, like, that's something I've heard a lot, because, like, people still think the AI is, like, really overbearing at points. And that,
well, sorry, go on.
It's just, like, I've gotten a lot of requests even still to nerf it, and I don't really know how to feel about it.
I would disagree, because I think you strike a good balance. It's the idea of games like Celeste, where an extreme difficulty is remedied as a player by lowering the punishment for it.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, especially, like, with the boss fight, I think you struck a good balance of it's a minor punishment where you lose a capture, but because it's not a overbearing punishment, you're able to crank up the AI and make it more tense and make it more aggressive, essentially.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the capture. Like, if you died every time you were captured by a Starling, the sewer and the plaza would have been so much harder. Yeah. And I guess also the nature of the sewer in particular, a lot of it is learning. So maybe death is, I don't know, that gets confusing. But
yeah.
Speaking of the gameplay of the sewer, one of the last like oh shit moments for me was Codebreaker. Mm-hmm. Was that always the plan to have another game running simultaneously?
Well, yes and no. I've always wanted to do that, but my original idea for Codebreaker is that it would have been a website with an HTML game embedded into it. That was like, okay, the original idea. Something I noticed after a while, though, is that I can't really load HTML files. Now, I can't really load video files through that, which kind of sucks. I wanted to do that originally, but I figured out that it couldn't. And then later on, I was like, what if it was like an earlier version of the game that has some issues? And that was kind of where the whole idea of Codebreaker came from. I thought it'd be interesting to give it like, I don't know, it's almost like you're like in a basement of sorts figuring stuff out through like a completely different game client. I always thought that was like an interesting choice there.
Yeah, I really, that was one of those moments where I'm like, okay, we found a link. Let me get into a barrel. Mm-hmm. I'm downloading an EXE. Yeah. Like that was a big moment.
Yeah.
And then obviously some of the, I think when we're talking about the puzzles and the codes within the game, we mentioned some of the ones that were misses, some of the ones that were hits. I've kind of been looking around to see some of the people's like things, puzzles that really resonated with players. And I think it being one of the last puzzles might be part of this, but it's such a smart one. I guess we'll call it the Dr. Seuss puzzle right at the end.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was one of those moments where I didn't know what to do. And granted, I'm like 6 hours into a stream, so like I'm tired. I don't know what's going on. I'm like, okay, I'll try the year. No, that didn't work. And then someone went, well, Google it. I was like, yeah, fair. We've had to do that in the past. And the moment the title came up, I felt like I got smacked in the face. That was cool.
Yeah, that one in particular took a lot of planning. I didn't know if I was people were gonna figure that one out on the first try. I think it worked out pretty well, things considered.
It worked out really well. I will say the end of my first playthrough, being so tired, I completely missed the video that shows you the invisible button for the last gate.
Yeah.
So we ended up having to, I booted up Unreal Unlocker and just clipped through the gate because I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
I'm like, look, we're doing this stream no matter what. Mm-hmm. But now knowing where that video is, that I think the aquarium is probably, the aquarium plus Codebreaker is probably like the tightest example of puzzle and game design combined. I think that's a really good solid section, and from what I hear, that is like one of that and a lot of people really enjoy the first time you go to the art museum or the art gallery.
I like that one too, actually. That was like one of the first puzzles I actually made for the game. Mm-hmm. That was like way earlier on at the time, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, keeping especially also because it's a teaching moment too, right? Where you get that code and you're like, oh, that's cool. And then later on when you see colors, you go, oh, and then you have to go back to like a previous note. And that's like one of the first like going back to earlier note moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the music ones. I like the music ones because I'm a music guy. Like I immediately clicked on that. But I saw you updated it, I think, the Helping Nub site to explain those. Was that like a common complaint?
No, a lot of people, I think it was Nightmind in particular who actually suggested I do that in the first place, but I remember his playthrough, he ended up saying, if you're given information in one particular level, players are going to expect that the information that they need to solve something is still in that level. A lot of them aren't taking notes because they're playing a game. But, you know, I intended it as an ARG thing from the start, but players didn't really see it that way at first. It led to the obtuse puzzles kind of like, well, it was a turnoff for a lot of them, unfortunately. But I figured adding like a resource for that, which you have to still figure out one code in order to find out.
Sure.
I thought that was like a good compromise on that end.
And speaking of, I did have a question there. I feel like there was a lot of really good reception to Shipwreck 64. One of those oh shit moments for, I know a lot of, for me and a lot of other people was the Nightmind video.
Yeah.
Kind of, I guess what was, did you know this was in the, I don't know if you're, what you're allowed to talk about or anything like that, but did you know that was even in the works? Was it just a blindside to you? Like, what was that experience like?
I remember the first time I found out about it, he was actually streaming the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching it. He had some ups and downs, but he really ended up liking it in the end. And I think he finished the first, he finished his first, like, full playthrough, 2 a.m. on the third day of streaming it. And I asked him what he thought, and he said, I have a lot of thoughts on it, and I'm going to save it for the Nightmind video, and I lost my mind, dude.
Nice.
I had no idea it was being produced at the time, but that's how I found out, and I was freaking out, dude.
Yeah, I still haven't finished the video, but I'm halfway through the second half. So, I love video essays. So, like, if the moment a video is over 2 hours, I'm interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I listen to it all the time, like, work on stuff. It's just really nice.
Nice. Yeah, because that was one of those moments where I saw that and I was like, oh, shit, that's a big video.
Yeah. And I'm glad, too, it actually caught on pretty well in the AOG community, which is something I was hoping for. It kind of missed every single mascot horror YouTuber in existence.
Which is weird to me, because I feel like I understand ARG community totally makes sense. Like, right up that alley. It ostensibly is very much a mascot. It literally has mascots in it. Like, I know the argument of, like, what is mascot horror? This is literally horror with mascot characters. Like,
okay. The general consensus of what I've heard is it's just not, like, marketable enough. That's, like, the big thing I've heard a lot of from, like, a lot of people. A good chunk of the community, like, mascot horror community, hasn't even played it. I gave a lot of them free copies, and a lot of them haven't even, like, redeemed them yet.
Interesting. So, yeah, I know, because, like, I haven't myself made a main channel video on it, but that's mainly because I'm terrified to not do FNAF. Because I need to eat. I've noticed, like, I've seen, I think one of the things I saw is, as a game, it's really well done that the horror doesn't happen until a bit later on, because it needs to make you comfortable. And I think maybe that's the, like, mascot horror player YouTubers are so used to, oh, I need it to be, like, marketable and thumbnail scary face immediately.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it, but I feel like it would have been a worse experience if it was, like, something was wrong right off the bat.
Yeah, if I rushed it, that would have been terrible. But, like,
yeah, like, it needs that slow drip feed.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. That has to be, like, built into the design right off the bat. Because if I don't do that, the game's gonna be, like, an absolute slog to play through. Because, like, what was it? With Poppy Playtime, this is the one I always come back to, because I really do not like that game. Mm-hmm. But, like, I've always hated, you can look in the thumbnail, you immediately see the monster, sharp teeth and everything like that. It's really appealing. You want to click on it. But by then, the surprise of this monster has already been completely taken away from you. You know what it's going to look like. You know what this character in particular is going to be a monster. So when you see, like, this giant hulky statue, and it disappears, you're like, oh, okay, he's gone now. That's cool. Like, you know, it's like, that surprise factor is completely gone. That's why even as far as Shipwreck goes, even on, like, the game's thumbnail and title, I don't show the costumes anywhere aside from the commercial. Yeah. I never once bring them up. And the Dwellers and Starlings were left completely out of the marketing, completely on purpose. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to show them at all until the game came out. That was, like, a main thing.
Yeah, and I remember there was the one Steam review where it was just like, man, this is weird. I played, like, an 8-minute N64 game and nothing happened. I'm like, why did you... The game makes fun of you if you do that. How did you miss literally, because even when I did my first playthrough, I was like, okay, well, let's play it normally on 97 mode and see what happens. And literally, I don't know how you play it normally on 97 mode and see the credit roll and not go, okay, yeah, we need to figure this out.
Yeah, it, like, tells you, get back in there, do something different.
The game literally tells you, go do this. Yeah, because I think there is that, like, this kind of comes back to the media literacy is dying argument, where, like, even games like Kenito Pet that came out pretty recently, has, like, the first time it's like, okay, thank you, and then a spooky thing happens, game closes. Literally 6 pop-ups come up and go, like, the game is not over, you need to go back and talk to Kenito, he's waiting for you, please reopen the game. Like, it's in your face. Like, and I wonder if that came from a similar, like, QA testing of people the first time it crashed goes, oh, that was cool, and stopped playing.
Okay, so that, the whole, like, the entire reason 2023 and 1987 are split into 2 different games, I will always hearken it back to this one Vinesauce stream. I think it was Vinny Vinesauce who played Shipwrecked. He, what is it? I'm still very mad about this stream. It still really bothers me.
Okay.
He played Shipwrecked. He beat it normally. And then didn't go back. He moved on to the next game. And then at the end of the stream, he Googled the scares. It's like, where was this in my playthrough? What? Why didn't I see this? Like, you didn't play the game, man. Like, yeah. And then I remember I commented on it saying, I'm sorry you didn't see this. I'll try to make sure it's better for next time. And I got so many replies that were just like, okay, if you need to, like, Google the scares to find it, you made a bad game. You designed it badly. So, like, that's why the entire, like, I literally have it now. So you have to play it normally. And then it tells you, do something different in the next version.
Go figure it out. Go be weird.
Yeah, that's why it's so, like, explicitly laid out. In the original, there was just the one version of where you could get any ending at any time.
Like, and I do think having to play 2023 is a good thing. It kind of harkens to the idea of, like, things feel more off-putting when you know what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, but it's just like, I wish I didn't have to do that, because, like, I'm not asking the world of you, man. Like,
I do wonder how many, like, 8-year-olds booted up Shipwreck 64 and thought the horror was horns. Horns is scary, and then they stopped playing.
Oh, that's embarrassing. Dude, could you imagine?
God, well, I mean, it's 8-year-olds playing horror games. What are you expecting?
Yeah.
I love my guy Horns.
Yeah, Horns is funny. I like him.
Yeah. I do have... Now, I don't know if this is something that hasn't been cracked, but it's been something that's been eating away at me for a long time. And I don't remember if I eventually ended up figuring it out, and it's in a notes somewhere, because I've got like 7 loose leaf papers scrawled. Speaking of Horns, you use the audio around Horns a lot, where it's that military alphabet listing off something.
Yeah.
Is that a code for something, or is that just sounds cool?
Okay, so in the case of Horns, originally when I was first designing the game, he was going to be like the main thing that was to be used for. And I kept hinting at it through like the teaser videos and stuff like that I was putting on the Kagura channels, where they would actually like show the forest and you hear like that noise playing. Originally, his noises were going to be like the most important thing, but I eventually used that for the door code instead. And I kept it on Horns because I felt like it'd be like a cool like red herring almost. Kind of like teasing the idea of using it. So like players get familiar with it.
Yeah.
And when it's like more explicitly, like they have a puzzle given to them, it's more like, oh yeah, I remember they were kind of like teasing that earlier.
Yeah, because I will say, it red herringed me real good. Because I was so focused on it with the, what volcano is it?
Mount Pinatubo, right?
Pinatubo, right.
Yeah.
That video, I think I spent, and now, granted, 2 a.m., you know. I think I sat there for like 30 minutes, like, okay, if we rearrange these letters, someone in chat literally was like, well, if you take the names of the characters that start with those letters and count vowels, we can use that. I was like, guys, no puzzle has been that weird. It can't be that.
I just Googled the name of the volcano.
Yeah, I literally just had to Google. It was one of those things where I was just so tired and everyone was so focused on, like, how weird of an answer can we get numbers at? How can we translate this video into numbers? And no one thought, just Google the fucking mountain.
My sincerest condolences on that.
No, that's one of those things where I think people are so used to ARGs having some weird bullshit puzzle. So when we ran into a wall, the assumption wasn't we're missing something. The assumption was, okay, we found the random bullshit puzzle. and then there wasn't one, so we just drove ourselves crazy. Because we just were missing something, just straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also, I didn't go, I think if I went into Walter's layer 3 area, I think I would have understood what to do better. But the two that I went into was Olivia and Giovanni, and those two. And I went there and I was like, okay, Pinatubo, we're not sure, let's come back. And then we went to Olives and none of us clocked the, because here's, now, this one I'm blaming you on, okay?
Yeah.
The achievement puzzle. Brilliant. I like it. In that same room, there's a log. And he lists 4 different things in there. So we spent 30 minutes going, okay, well, so there was the chest thing, the wolf thing. There was the 2 other things that Connor lists in that dev log. We need to find out how many of each of those are in the dev zone. And if we count it up, that's our code.
Okay, yeah, the big hints towards it, the achievement icon is on the monitor.
Yeah, we saw that and we're like, okay, coconuts, right, because the devlog.
Yeah, but as well, it's also, what is it, the devlog itself is also like actively describing all those levels for like the first half of it. That was kind of like what I was hoping.
Yeah,
was away.
That was, I think that was, went right over our heads because we were so tired.
Yeah,
that was the end of the first stream, so that was like 6 hours in, 2 a.m. kind of thing. it was one of those things where we were like, okay, well, the devlog listed four things, so clearly that must be the answer. And it wasn't even that the devlog listed four things, we just found a way to interpret it as if there was four things in the devlog. Because those were, I think, really my only two stumbles where I was like, okay, I don't know what the answer here is. Maybe I'm too tired. Mm-hmm. And I think that night was when I DM'd you. I'm like, Squeaks, please, I'm on my knees. Give me a hint, but don't give it away. There's a bit of a technical mishap, but we're back. Essentially, you didn't miss much. We just talked about books. Who cares?
Yeah.
So, we are kind of at the end of the podcast. We're about an hour in. Is there anything coming up on the pipeline for yourself or Shipwrecked or Broadside Beach or anything like that? Obviously, don't feel pressured to give away things if things are down the. And I'm not, God forbid, when's the next update? You know, whatever. But what's next for Squeaks and the team?
All right, so I am working on a DLC at the minute.
Okay.
It's not like fully finished. It's like we're still planning it out right now. Like it's like mostly planned. It's actually getting to the gameplay aspect is going to be a little difficult. It's been coming on pretty well, all things considered. I do want to try to add to it in a more organic way, so we're kind of justifying it, calling it ROM hacks. I feel like that's
okay. That would make a lot of sense with like the mythos built up around this game.
Yeah, you can't really update a cartridge. That's not a thing that happens. But I think all things the way we're handling it is pretty good.
Interesting. Well, I'm really excited for it, and obviously, for anyone in the comments, before you get annoying, it'll be done when it's done.
Yeah.
All right.
it'll take a while, obviously, but
yeah, no, and I mean the Miyamoto quote, the Rush game bad forever, yada yada yada.
Yeah. funny Mario guy says funny thing.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much. There is a teaser for that as well, so there's two links in the description, obviously, well, probably multiple because there's going to be socials and things like that. But Shipwreck 64 store page in there. If you have not bought it, why are you still watching? This was the spoiler segment, asshole, but still play it. It's really good. If you haven't yet, and if you have, play it again. And then underneath that, there's a teaser for some upcoming stuff with the franchise, so maybe go check that out as well. But thank you for coming on. This was such an amazing opportunity. So thanks for hanging out with me. And for the folks at home, thank you for hanging out for the Freddy Fazbear Pizza Podcast. I need my outro because I tabbed out of it. Where the pizza abilities are endless, we hope to enjoy your future patronage. Bye-bye for now.